Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Brad Gilmore Show Network, another edition of BG Show Archive for you right now, here live and in living color, brother. Today's episode is really nice. We have the one and only, the RZA, Bobby Digital from the Wu-Tang Clan. I conducted this interview back in 2012. I got an email all of a sudden saying, hey, we heard of you. We want you to come interview the RZA for his upcoming directorial debut, The Man with the Iron Fists. So without even thinking twice, I, boom, responded, I'll be there. Here's my information. I'll see you then. And they sent back the date, and it was Tuesday. I was like, oh, Tuesday. Back in the day, that's when I did my live online radio show. And it was actually at the same time the show started, 3 o'clock. So I was like, damn, what am I going to do? And not only that, you know, I was trying to figure out, okay, what am I going to do? How am I going to do the show and do the show, the interview with RZA? And on the show today, on that day, I had DJ DMD, so I had a pretty big and important guest on that show and on the show with the RZA. But it all ended up working out. I called in from Warehouse Live, which is where the interview was done here in Houston, called into the show, did the intro, DJ Motai spun for like an hour, because it was a 3-hour live broadcast. And then finally, I get there at like the very end, like the ninth hour, to interview DJ DMD and to interview Hash Brown. Took me forever, but I was able to get this RZA interview. Excuse the audio quality of the interview. It was conducted with a, you know, condenser microphone in the middle of the room, so it sounds like crap, but sounds good enough for you. Sounds good enough for you to enjoy my interview with the one and only, the RZA. What's up, everybody? This is Brad Gilmore with the Brad Gilmore Show. I am sitting down with Bobby Digital, aka the leader and founder of the Wu-Tang Clan, also known as the RZA. We're here talking about his new movie, The Man with the Iron Fist, in theaters November 2nd. Now, RZA, I want to start by asking you something. I saw the trailer, and I noticed there was like a hint of comedy in it. Was that something that you and Eli Roth did intentionally when you were writing the script?
Yeah, yep. And Eli was especially helpful in that zaniness, because he's a zany guy. And I'm considered to be more serious, but I'm actually working on my comedy. And working on it. So, no, we definitely wanted humor, irony, as well as outrageousness. All these elements had to take place in the middle of this world because, you know, this is a fictional film based in a non-fiction environment, but we didn't want to take it so serious, you know what I mean? And so we added those elements, those comedic elements. And I remember one day we even just, you know, there's one scene when Russell and Lucy are going through their thing, right? And it says, you know, she's like, you damage my girls, I damage your boys, right? But that scene, the way it was written already, but the way I wanted to shoot it, I figured it out like 2 days before I shot it. And I didn't tell the actors yet. And then when I figured out, I had to knock on his trailer first, and I was like, listen, you do that scene, I want you to get your nose and your lip so close to her that you can almost taste her, right? Because they have no relationship like that, but I want them to like to get it. I said, then when you get that close to her, just stick your tongue out. And lick her lip. He looked at me. Okay, is she cool with that, Bobby? I said, no way, I'm gonna talk to her next. I'll just make sure you're cool with it. She said, I'm cool with it. And I went to her, told her, and she said, is Russell cool with that? I said, yeah, he cool.
Seeing as though this is your directorial debut, what kind of director do you want to be known as?
A serious director, like a person that really could take a story and put on this big screen and entertain the audience. Okay. Not just because, like, we've seen many movies come out every year, and sometimes we feel cheated out of our little $12. Yeah. I'm a movie buff. I go to the movies. Practically, when I'm home, every Wednesday is movie day. I mean, for me and my wife, that's what we do, and it's hard to waver from that. And sometimes we go and I'm entertained, but a lot of times you like, especially her, she's like, you know, and when she don't like something, you know, it really gets me. But I want to be able to make movies that entertain us first and foremost. And that can happen sometimes. Just a comedy could be stupid.
Yeah.
You know, no disrespect. This comedy, I ain't gonna say that this movie is stupid because I love this movie, but look at Pineapple Express. It's just have fun.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. But it's that 95 minutes you spent, you don't even know what you call the movie's about. All you know is that you have fun. So I want to be a guy that make sure that we make films that's entertaining and fun.
Now, you talked about, like, telling a story, and, you know, you're used to coming from, like, the music realm where you try to get your point across in a song, like, when you're producing a record in, like, 4 or 5 minutes. How was it making that transition from songs to making films? Like, how difficult was that?
I think it is more difficult to expand upon thoughts. Actually, in a song, because the songs are abstract, you could say in four lines, and the listener could figure it out. You take a Paul Simon song, 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover. He says, the problem is all inside your head. She said to me, the answer is easy if you take it, say lightly. I'd like to help you in your struggle to be free. Explain 50 ways to leave your lover. That's four lines. The relationship is over.
Mm-hmm.
For writing a screenplay, it's not really all about the words sometimes. You know what I mean? Because it's visual. And that's where the difficult part comes at. To be able to have, you know, 30 seconds to 3 minutes of something you're looking at and it holds you there. You know? You know, I looked at directors like John Woo, Quentin Tarantino, and Jim Jarmusch. And Quentin Tarantino is my mentor. But when I was with Jim Jarmusch, I noticed that he'll do long shots, that he'll just stay on the character sometimes. But sometimes so long that you begin to think what the character's thinking. You're trying to think what he's thinking. And now that may work, but it doesn't work on Hollywood movies because the attention span is always cut. He's trying to keep you moving. If you look at John Woo, and he have a long shot, the same thing, but everything is blowing up on that shot. The tissue is flying, the birds is moving. You stimulate it. Quentin will do the same thing, and the dialogue will be so intense. That look at the Inglourious Basterds, and the guy that said the milk, and you watch him drink the milk. The milk in that movie seemed like it was ice cold, didn't it? You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
But it's probably hot as fists. So there's different ways that they bring it. So me, I try to incorporate some of these styles and make sure that when you're looking at a film, my film, you got some eye candy that's making you just, wow, a lot of things going. Or here go a few lines that make you get your laugh off. Or here go just a scene. You know what I mean? Just look at, like when the Gemini Killers ride into town in this movie, they ride into town and the music is playing. And for a moment, I know it's going to work on the audience because it works on me. For a moment, you just kind of sit back and go, that's nice. And they just coming in, pretty girl, guy, and the whole scene is just them riding in the town. I take it all the way till they get off their horses. That's bold to hold a shot that long, you know what I mean? But, you know, it worked. I think you guys will like it.
Now, you talked about Quentin Tarantino being a sensei of sorts. Could you kind of like divulge more details on you and Quentin's relationship and the making of this film?
Yeah, when he was working on Kill Bill, we had became friends early on. And when he worked on, when he wrote the screenplay for Kill Bill, he had gave me a copy. And I read it, and then I was like, wow, it was incredible. And we hung around each other for, you know, maybe 2 years at this point. And I just recognized in him a unique talent of encyclopedia knowledge of film. A man who had my same love for certain genres, saw Spaghetti Western and Martial Art. But a man who had thousands of other films in his catalog and in his brain. And I said, yo, as you go direct this film, I like to be your student. Could you mentor me? And he said, sure, Bobby, be my pleasure. And I flew to Beijing, and on the set of Kill Bill, I just sit up in that, like a high old seat we had, it was like a balcony almost, and I'll be there with a composition notebook, writing notes. And I did that for the first 30 days. Then I went to Mexico and did it again for a couple more weeks. And same thing on Death Proof. I flew down to Austin and I and also many times, many nights at his house. The coolest thing for me though was on the set of The Man with the Iron Fist, Quentin comes to China. And he's sitting there at Video Village, and he says, "Bobby, this is full circle. Remember, it started in China, Beijing. You and that black notebook sitting up there, and now look, the student has become a master."
Now, there's been a lot of, you know, MCs and hip-hop guys who've transitioned in the movie world, you know, like M and 36 Mafia won their Academy Award, you know, 50 Cent. Do you feel like movies and hip-hop go together, and you feel like that's the next logical step to move the culture forward, for you at least?
Yeah, I think me personally, I'm definitely going to continue to make films. I don't know if every hip-hop artist could do it, because I don't know if they all prepared themselves for the task.
Yeah.
Looking at a man that, you know, even from this story, Iron Fist, this is starting in 2005, and then we finally get this visualized in 2012. But through that period of time, looking at a guy who studied, read books, watched movies, deciphered movies, spent time with some of the elite directors, acted in over 12, 13 films, and appeared on TV. So I had a chance to really learn it. So I do see myself as being one of the hip-hop brothers that will open up the possibility of a hip-hop artist doing it. But you just can't do it because you're a hip-hop artist.
Yeah.
You just can't do it because you sold millions of records and you're famous. That's something that when Sam Jackson was complaining about hip-hop artists getting acting jobs some years ago, he challenged me, actually, to go and learn this craft instead of taking it on face value. So I went and got an acting coach, and I got books, and I studied the Susan Bassin School of Acting, which goes way back to the Russian School of Acting. And I went forward to learn it, so that when I do it, Sam was not going to look at me and say, "I'm not a thespian." You know what I mean? And then on Django, I had a chance to sit down and kick it with him and talk. And you know, he basically was like, "Boy, go ahead and put the wig on and do Afro Samurai. You ready, man?" But he sees that, you know, that I have the artistic qualities of an actor. It's not a, you know, it's a very small circle of actors in the world. Mm-hmm. Artists, period. I'm going to share this with y'all real quick. If you look at the Directors Guild, it's only 3,000 members. Look at SAG, maybe there's 100,000 members. You know, the Writers Guild, maybe you get 5,000, 6,000 members. Mm-hmm. You add all these numbers together, let's say you end up with 200,000 people. Out of 7 billion, this is the core of that talent. You take journalists, same thing you guys are. Maybe if you find 1 million of them, that's out of 7 billion. You divide that into 7 billion, you lose it. Same thing with artists and singers. Let's say the whole world, from journalists to artists to singing to dancing to, let's say we find 5 million of us. You divide that into 7 billion, it's lost. So we have a rare thing we do. Mm-hmm. And the more you enhance that talent, the more rare you become. So now we take a person like Russell Crowe, who's in The Man with the Iron Fist, and there's less than 100 men in history who says, best male leading actor, Oscar. Less than 100 men got that power and got that title, you know? So, you know, it's something we should take serious, and I take it serious, and I respect the craft of it, and I put my time and I studied, and I basically walked away from an empire to do this, basically. If I look at it, my brother come here right now. He'll tell you.
Now, when working on the soundtrack for the album, you know, you collaborated with all your Wu-Tang brothers and Kanye West and whatever. But when working with the Wu-Tang brothers, did it spark, you know, that interest to do another Wu-Tang project?
Actually, it didn't spark that interest yet. We have next year is our 20th year anniversary, and I've been reaching out to the guys, you know, to make that year special. November 2013 will be the 20th anniversary of Enter the 36 Chambers, the album that we brought to the world that made us who we are and put our names on the map and helped change the world in its own way. But hopefully the guys will see, hopefully everybody, I mean some brothers do see it, me and Ghost we talk about it, me and Matt we talk about it at different times. Hopefully everybody will see the importance of us coming together, no matter what we do, whether it's a concert, an album, or just Parents on Good Morning America. Whatever it is, we need to come together and show the fans who supported us that we respect their support. We change this forever. We said it. We can't be talking no bull crap. We got to live it out. So, but this particular project, because, I mean, Jimmy Fallon invited us to perform a song off the soundtrack on Monday or Tuesday, and I'm hearing that some of the guys ain't making it on Jimmy Fallon. So I'm like, well, they're not ready yet. You know what I mean? So that's just for your knowledge.
Any interest in an actual Wu-Tang movie, maybe?
Yeah, I think actually a few of us have ideas that we're jotting down. So I know Raekwon may be writing some ideas, GZA writing some ideas, myself. So we'll see if life gives us that blessing.
Now, how do you want people to feel when they listen to the movie as well as watch it?
Well, I'm from the old school, as they say, mm-hmm. and I'm a record collector. And when I collected soundtracks from the 70s, like Shaft or Claudine or Superfly, you know what I mean? Or even Brothers with Taj Mahal. When you get these albums, Coffee, Voyeurs, the music matches the film. You can put the album on and almost see the film in your head. So when I did Ghost Dog, I took it the same way. And now that the Mail the Iron Fist, my idea is that, yeah, you should be able to put this CD in or download it to your computer, whatever you do, and envision the film. I had a writer talk to me in D.C. who got an early copy of the score and soundtrack, and he said he think he saw the movie. So I was like, okay, well, and that was just him telling me that. I said, yo, I'm going to tell you, man, let's just go. It's like, I saw the movie. I was like, well, I guess it worked. Yeah. But that's the main plan for a score or soundtrack, is mm-hmm. to make you feel like you're getting that movie experience again in your car.
Now, how is it though, like, because I know the movie's set in like old school 19th century China, and like, how is it when like an audience member is watching the movie and then they see like a current hip-hop star, R&B star, like pop up in the movie? Like, how do you make that fit?
Well, I didn't worry about the time period. Being a Tarantino student and from that school, I knew that I could break certain rules. You know what I mean? So you're looking at Glorious Bastard, which is in the 40s, and David Bowie came on. So I just knew that I could break that rule, and I broke it. But I think the way I broke it, it still captures you, and it captures your imagination in the film. You know, in other words, here Kanye West in the movie, and he is in the movie, it's not going to take you out of the scene, because it was written for the scene. It was properly planned for the scene. And so therefore it fits this thing. There's other cues in the movie that sound just like, you know, Asian sound. There's some that sound like, there's one crazy hardcore hip hop beat from a Wu-Tang album that we changed around. And we had John Frusciante on lead guitar, Chavo Adagio from System of a Down on bass. And it's rumbling, all these guitars, but it's a big fight scene. But it just sucks you into it. You know what I mean? So that'd be different. That's what makes this film unique, though. The trick I think I did here, and the trick that the studio also paid attention to, was the Asian brothers and sisters make 50 to 100 of these movies a year.
Yeah.
Whether you come from Singapore, Thailand, Hong Kong, Japan, these films come out all the time. Korea. What makes mine different? Who want to give an American guy a shot to do what these guys do every day? Well, they don't got hip hop. They don't got that. You know what I'm saying? They don't have this American sensibility to where 85-90% of this film is English speaking actors, even though they're Chinese. Mm-hmm. They're the generation of actors, man, who can speak English. But they have to, like Daniel Wu, who's one of the biggest stars in China, he has to speak Chinese in every one of his movies, but he's from Oakland. You know what I mean? So now he gets to speak his English in my movie. None of these films have the Quentin Tarantino sensibility. This is why Quentin Tarantino presents it. It separates us automatically. But being able to throw that hip hop music in there and have fun with it changes the game.
So, like, what are some martial arts movies that you watch either during, before, or even after this movie that you really enjoy, you know, watching?
Well, I'm always watching martial arts films. So, of course, I like Ip Man, 14 Blades, Detective D, and Holy Flame. The Raid is crazy. I saw the Raid doing editing. They actually bought the Raid to me.
Okay.
And streamed it to me. because they wanted my opinion. Now, no, this shit is crazy. The Vader is dope. Now, if I was to be a movie critic, I said, what's the problem with the Raid? The acting. You know what I mean? It's like, the quality of acting is not there. Mm-hmm. They don't have a cast member at the level of a Russell Crowe. Yeah. So that's another element that I added to the Asian film. And me and Russell have talked about this, because he had called me up and he was like, you know, Bobby, I'm not doing no Kung Fu. I said, listen, bro, I got Dave Bautista, Kung Lee, Rick Yoon, Gordon Liu. I got all the Kung Fu I need in this movie. What I need from you is that quality acting ability that only you could bring. You know what I mean? So I knew what I needed to start my stew. I knew I had all these ingredients, but I had to have this special spice to make it delicious.
Well, I know RZA, bro. I know you worked with Pam Grier on the movie. How was it getting her on the film and, you know, interacting with Pam Grier, the queen of, like, black exploitation films?
Well, that was a blessing, yo. A pure honor. She's such a lady. I'm such a fan of hers. You know, when I told my wife about the cast of this movie, you know, I'm in China, and we still, you know, people, the producers are negotiating, you know, and it's a big process to get put in the film, but I learned that the hard way. Well, I'll say one last thing. I may never want to do another screen test again after looking at people's screen tests with a group of people and like, oh my God, fashion. I don't know if I ever want to do it again. But anyway, so I call home to my wife. I'm like, yeah, baby. So Russell's on. And Lucy's on. Oh, cool. You know, Rick, they agreed to Rick. I got Daniel. I got Gordon Liu, baby. One of my favorite. I know that's nice, baby. Baby, and we got Pam Grier. Pam Grier! We got Pam Grier! Oh, baby, this is going to be great. So that's how important it was. I told Pam that, too. I said, man, you're the only one that made my wife smile about being in the movie. And she was a great lady. She had so many good things to tell us. I did something funny. I'll share this with y'all. I know how you're deciphering, but there's an old martial art movie that Bruce Lee made called Return of the Dragon.
Yeah.
Where he fights Chuck Norris. All right, that movie's about the white guy comes to take over the Chinese restaurant. Okay, I got that white guy. And John plays this thing with Pam Grier. So I put the 270 exploitation people together in one scene. So I did a lot of tricks in this movie that's like cinema foul things that you'll see, like, oh, he put that in there just for the moviegoers to realize, you know. And I pay homage to films, and you'll notice when I'm paying homage, and you also will notice when, wow, this guy's imagination is quite his own.
Now, in the trailer, we don't see a lot about your character Blacksmith, let alone any action scenes. So how was it being able to get in there, embrace your inner Staten Island, and, you know, kick a little ass during the film?
Well, no, the character, the Blacksmith, is actually a very humble character.
Oh, okay.
So, I actually took the role in Californication last season just so that people don't mistake me for this guy. You know what I mean? Honestly, yeah. I was like, man, I got to do something else. And this guy is very, very eternal, you know what I mean? But he has something that's useful. You know what I mean? And you'll discover in the film that he has something that's very useful. He's learned something that's very important. And that's the only part of him I could resonate with myself when I was being stupid as a young adult, you know, between the age of 19 and 21, I guess, is that I had all this common sense and read all these books and had all this so-called wisdom, and I was doing stupid shit every day. You know what I mean? And it wasn't until a tragedy happened to me, I almost lost my whole life and lost everything that I have today from a foolish mistake. I was able to escape that mistake and live another day, and I never turned back negative again. I stayed positive throughout the course. And that's something I could say is a part of that character that I could agree with and I see. You know what I mean? It wasn't even planned like that. It's just when I watched the film, I thought, oh yeah, that's some shit. Like my own, you know, life imitating art and art imitating life.
For those who didn't experience Kung Fu films as a child, what do you want them to take from this movie?
Well,
this film?
One thing, I think it's a good film, even if you take all the kung fu out, you got mm-hmm. a good film, okay. right? But I would love the people who haven't watched kung fu and don't know the genre that we're bringing to find a love for this stuff, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, I would love young people to feel like, you know, even though this movie is, you know, it's Eli Roth, so you know we got some gore, all right? But I would love for young people, you know, to fight with their hands. They learn martial art. You know, when Karate Kid came out, it caused a little boom of people joining karate schools. Mm-hmm. In Bruce Lee days, it made a boom of it. Hopefully, you know, this may even give a spark of it, man, because the gun violence and all that stuff that's happening out there is ridiculous. You know, I was a kid, we had Saturday morning kung fu game. You guys don't got that no more. You know what I mean? But it's in some of those movies that you find loyalty, brotherhood, sacrifice, fight against oppression, you know what I mean? As well as just some cool ass kicking.
Yeah.
And that's missing, you know? And I think that this film is like a film to bring it back. It won't be Saturday mornings, it'll be more like Friday and Saturday nights.
Yeah.
But I would love to see more of this. Also, one more thing. When Kill Bill came out, did we all like Kill Bill here at this time?
Yeah, yeah. Yes.
Okay, did we all like Kill Bill? All right, so that was the last American film that focused on martial art. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's the last one that had real money on it, real people in it. And here's the next one. So how many years later, y'all? I don't think it should be this far apart. Even when I decided to do the movie, when I told Quinn I'm ready to be a director, mm-hmm. he gave me some advice. He said, well, maybe you should start with a small movie at a certain amount of money and just, you know, do something simple. I didn't. I went for the big one, you know what I mean? because I noticed, though, and I'll just speak this on the commercial level, I said, Quinn, when we did Kill Bill, it was successful. Mm-hmm. Everybody saw it, probably made a couple hundred million dollars with it, and yet now, we can't even get a kung fu movie like when Curse of the Golden Flower came out, it couldn't even play on 100 screens. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I said, so there's a market for people who's hungry for this stuff. If you don't fulfill it, well, let your student do it. He said, okay, you take it. You know, he's going on to other things. So I said, I'd love to take over that genre. And you know, I come with the iron fist. And I said, this is the only kind of films I want to make. I got a lot of ideas. But if I only made these kind of films, I'd still be satisfied.
So out of the 1990s, you actually had a movie that you wrote and wanted to make. Whatever happened with that?
Bobby Digital? Yeah, Bobby Digital, yeah. I actually wrote that as no script. I just wrote like two pages, and I shot it. I got it. It's in my archives as one of my amateur films.
Okay.
And I don't know if it's going to ever leak out. If it do, I won't be embarrassed now. Now I realize, you know, it's like thinking of the old music days when we had only turntables and 606 drum machines, and now we got big samplers and Logic on our computers to make music. So, but it was an amateur film called Bobby Digital. I did another amateur film I did called Wu-Tang vs. the Golden Phoenix. But the Wu-Tang vs. the Golden Phoenix, some of the footage from that, I edited together into a trailer, and it was that which helped me get the people to believe that I could do The Man with the Iron Fist. They saw that I had some knowledge of action and talent, and I was also able to get Asian actors to work with me, you know what I mean? Which is sometimes difficult for us, you know, to get people to work for us, one reason or another, but I had the sensibility, and the Chinese government has to clear every movie. They have to read the script and clear it. One thing about this movie, which it is fiction, but you also will notice that we don't really mention too many authentic Chinese things. We couldn't even say Peking duck. It was in the script. It was like Peking duck. Like, no, you can't say Peking duck. Peking duck is real. Okay. it's a tradition of theirs. It's one of their big foods. I couldn't even say Shaolin. And I'm a student of Shaolin. I've been to Shaolin Temple. I've been ordained a Shaolin disciple. And I couldn't say it because Shaolin is real. So I had to change the name of my temple to Wu Chi.
The government wouldn't allow you?
They wouldn't allow
that.
Well, because they're protecting their culture.
Yeah.
And this is a movie that's a piece of fiction. And it can't be like, oh, this, because people watch movies and believe it. So they're protecting their culture. And I respected it.
Right.
So why do you think, like, kung fu movies don't translate to the United States audience? Like, they're not as popular here in the States.
Well, I think that because they're made from their perspective, their sensibility. You know, the Asian, like I said this earlier to a guy, like you'll watch an Asian, oh, especially in the 80s or 70s, they have a scene where the guy gets up late, he has to take a piss. He pisses in a piss holder. And then he's kind of still sleeping. And she's like, Romeo, bring me some tea. That's not that. It's funny, but it ain't that funny. It's funny for a kid.
Yeah.
I just say there's certain sensibilities that they have in their films that doesn't resonate with how we make our films. So the same thing with, you know, I mean, our films actually do well in Asia, which is weird. But I don't know. It's just something I think that that's an ingredient that hopefully that Iron Fist will do well, and they will watch it and enjoy it as well. Maybe they pick up a trick from me because I picked up some of these tricks from them. Maybe they go, okay, we have to add a little bit of this to our stuff, or pull back on this, or know when it's serious, know when it's funny, and know when it's kung fu. Personally, how I feel about this film this time. Let's tell you how I feel about this film this time of the year. I feel like there's two holidays: Thanksgiving and Christmas. I have your Thanksgiving turkey right here, the mail guy. And it's presented by Quentin Tarantino. And then Quentin Tarantino comes back on Christmas Day with the Christmas turkey.
Right.
These two films should be the best two rated R movies of the fourth quarter, and the funnest.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah, I honestly believe that. And I know I got some nice ingredients in mind that's going to uphold, and I know he got some crazy ingredients in his, so it's going to be fun.
Sounds like some good meals. Good meals.
The cranberry sauce, kid.
Thanks, guys.
Hey, I want to thank y'all very much.
Thank you.